Well, good morning. Still morning for 3 more minutes. It's been a little while since I spoke here the last time, because the last time I was supposed to speak, I skipped it because I was sick. I was supposed to speak the last week of December, which was almost exactly a month ago, but I got very sick that week leading up to the Sabbath. In fact, it was the sickest that I can remember that I've ever been in my life. I had tick bite fever. 2 weeks prior to that, Ed, Ethan, Jake, and I went deer hunting. It was on the first Monday of deer season, which was, I guess it was probably 3 weeks before that. And we went out on the first day of deer season. It turned out to be a very good day of deer hunting, especially for Ethan. You probably know he shot 2 deer, an 8-point and a doe, and Jake shot a deer as well. So we had 3 deer on the ground all before lunchtime. But we were so far up on this ridge that it took us until 5 o'clock that night to get them back to the truck. We had to drag them, I'll say almost 5 hours, I'd say, over rocks and logs and uphills and downhills and through briars. It was horrible. I felt like I was going to collapse and die. Several times I did just collapse. Ethan did too, and just lay there on the ground for a while, take the breaks. We even had to load the deer into a boat and cross the stream to get them back to our truck. That's how far up we were. But just the exhaustion of that day felt like it nearly killed me. But all that work was not the worst thing that happened that day. Because as I mentioned before, I got a tick. I didn't notice the tick at first, but it had attached itself to my chest. It attached itself right here under my chest. And it was 2 days later before I'd even noticed it was there, because my chest started to get sore right here. And I started rubbing. Why is this sore? And I noticed it. It was just a tiny little tick. Of course, once I saw it, I pulled it off. And I checked it, make sure the head and everything was still on, and I flushed it and got rid of it. I thought, well, that's the end of that. I've had lots of ticks in my life, probably hundreds of ticks throughout my life, and I always pulled them off, never had a problem. But this time, the area around where I had this tick got really sore. My chest got really sore. And eventually, the glands up under my armpit right here started to swell up, and they got really, really sore. In fact, I couldn't even hold my arm down here normally at my side, because it just got like a lump underneath my armpit here. And I got really sore. A couple days later, of course, I just tried to ignore all this. I figured out it'd get away. A couple days later, I started to get a rash on my chest. It started to break out in a rash. It wasn't just a rash, but it was like really sore. You could hardly touch it. It was just really sore rash on my chest. And then the day after that, I started to get fevers. I had fevers on and off for like 4 days. Like, it seemed like they were like flash fevers. I'd have chills, like shivering, literally 1 minute, and then a few minutes later I'd be sweating, like literally like cold sweats the next minute. Of course, I left it go. I figured, oh, this will run its course. I'll be all right. Thinking I'd just get over it. And this went on for over a week, maybe a week and a half. Not the fevers. The fevers were about 4 days, but this whole process. I had about 4 days of these fevers. Then the headaches start about after 4 days of fevers. This terrible pounding. I mean, just like throbbing in the back of my head. And my back started to hurt, and all of my ache near muscles and joints just started aching. I was just feeling terrible. Like I said, I don't remember ever in my life feeling this bad. I mean, I felt really bad. This was literally the worst I had ever felt in my life. So after 4 days of fever, I went to the doctor. I finally said, I'm going to the doctor. And they took blood tests, and they found out that it was a bacterial infection in my blood caused by this tick. And they prescribed 2 weeks of these antibiotics. They said they were very strong antibiotics. I don't even know what they were. But eventually, it worked, and it cleared it up. It's amazing how much better I felt after 3 days of those antibiotics. It really made a difference. I should have went earlier. But I can remember a moment as I was laying there in bed, shivering with fever. I can remember thinking this to myself. How fragile is my life? How fragile my life really is? This one little tick, the size of an ant. I mean, it wasn't even a big tick. It was a little thing. Size of an ant can bite me, and I feel like I'm going to die. Because that's the way I felt. How fragile life really is. It was a humbling place to be when you feel like that. Our human lives really are fragile. Turn over to Psalms 144 to start out today. Our human lives are very fragile, as I found out by getting that little tick bite. Psalms 144 verse 4 says, man is like a breath. His days are like a fleeting shadow. Our days are like a fleeting shadow. All of us will die. None of us are exempt, and none of us will escape that eventuality, unless we happen to be here, of course, when Christ returns. None of us have the power to prevent our own death. Now, a wealthy person does have a better chance of living longer than a poor person. People in poverty don't live as long as people who live in wealthier nations. In the year 2000, a wealthy person in our country could expect to live 4.5 years longer than a poor person. And men in the most deprived countries had 10 less years of life expectancy than women in more affluent countries. Now, the disparity of the life expectancy is due, they say, mostly to education, lifestyle, unsafe communities, and the lack of good health care. But the lives of the rich and the poor both will end at some point. Psalm 90, verse 5. You can just write this one down. Psalm 90, verse 5. You can carry them away like a flood. They are like a sleep. In the morning they are like grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and it withers. Again, it's talking about how fleeting our life really is. In the morning it grows up. In the evening it cuts down. It is cut down and withers. I remember Clint Eastwood saying in one of his movies, he said, "We all got it coming, kid." He was talking to a young man. And that's true. We all got it coming. None of us will escape. But this does not mean that our physical death marks the end of our existence. Of course, we know that. If we were to think of our life as like a timeline, and we begin that timeline with the eternity that happened before we came along, that would be a long, long line. It goes on forever. It goes on for infinity. And then you follow that line up to this point when you were born. And then you look at that line, how far it would be till you die. And of course, once you die, there's an eternity that goes beyond that. And when you think of it in that aspect, our life is like a little speck on that line. It's not even that big on that line, obviously, because an eternity before us, an eternity after us, our life lasts that long. It's a tiny little speck. And when you look at it this way, you realize what's a small speck of time we really have as physical beings. So what do we do with this brief speck of time that we are granted in this life? Does how we use this tiny speck of time have any impact on our eternal future? Well, of course it does. We all know that it does. That is why we are here today. But for a good moment, or a good amount of my life, I lived as though my life has not yet started. Especially when you're young. When you're a child, I can remember thinking how great it would be to grow up when I got bigger. Always looking to the future. When I got bigger, I remember how wonderful it would be when I could get out on my own and make my own life, do what I wanted to do, drive a car, get out of school, be on my own. Then as a young adult, as I got older still, I remember thinking how great my life would be when I could build a house, buy a farm, start my own business, still always looking into the future. Now, at the point of life where I am, I tend to think how great it's going to be when I buy the next place and I can retire, still looking to the future. But we cannot always be looking off to the future. Life is happening right now, not someday in the future. There may never be a someday. The same could be true of those who are older than me. They may actually do the opposite and dwell on the past, dream about how things used to be. Now, dreaming is important, but forgetting to live now places the future beyond what is happening here in the present. And remembering the beauty of yesterday is also good, but living in the past robs us of what is happening today in the present. We need to live today. Life is happening right now. This little speck of time that we have in our lives is what's important right now. Time matters because time is what life is made out of. When the time is gone, life is gone. So that little speck of time that we have, we need to use wisely. Now, all of us are slaves to time. Whether we admit it or not, we are all slaves to time. You can just see how we communicate to see that nowadays. If you're over 50, you probably remember writing handwritten letters, which of course took much more time to do. If you're between 30 and 50, you probably rely on email. That's how I communicate. I communicate with email. Saves time. If you're under 30, you probably instant message and text. You don't even use full words. You just use letters, and you're supposed to figure out what those words mean. That's younger than me. I don't understand how you can text or even read text. I've never texted before. If you're under 30, you probably communicate with Facebook or MySpace or maybe even tweet. I've never tweeted before. I don't know if anybody here has tweeted. But again, these are ways that we communicate to save time because we are slaves to time. Time is so important to us. For most of us, time matters more than money. We will spend money to save time. But probably our parents would have spent time to save money. It's kind of the opposite nowadays. In a world where most of us feel stressed out, we value our free time more than we value a few extra dollars in our pocket. At least that's the way I feel sometimes. But the question is, how much time do you have left? Good question. Nobody knows. And I would like to phrase it another way. What time is it in your life? What time is it? This is the question I will attempt to answer today. What time is it? Not only what time is it in your life, but what time is it in the church? And what time is it in the world? Now God gives us the answers to all three of these questions. I'm going to start with question number one. What time is it in my life? Where am I in the great scheme of things, as far as the beginning, the middle, and the end of my life? Where am I? What time is it? Now you would probably all agree with me that time flies. And I find, as many of you who are older, or as old as I am, that time flies as you get older. Something happens when you get older. And when you turn around 40 years old, I'm 44 now. But it seems like time just flies by. You can't believe how fast it goes by. When I turned 40, I began to realize I don't have the same body that I did when I was 20. I remember my dad grunting and groaning every time he sat down and every time he got up. I thought, oh, I'm never going to be that way because I don't have to grunt and groan when I stand up or sit down. But now I do, for some reason. When I get up and get down, I grunt and groan. It hurts. Time is flying by. I also see my eyesight changing. I can no longer see things up close. I can't read. We have these antibiotics we give our calves sometimes, and the wording on there is so small, I just can't read it. So things like that, I always have to get someone else to read it for me. Or finally, I did break down and went to Walmart and got those reading glasses you can get real cheap. So I'm too cheap to go to the eye doctor and get real glasses. Those help. So I got a pair of those. So my eyesight's going. My hearing isn't as good either. Now I find myself, when I'm listening to Renita in her conversation, because I always just stand there and listen to what she's saying, when she's talking to people, because I don't like to talk too much. But now I find myself actually having to look at her, because I can't really hear what she's saying unless I'm looking at her mouth at the same time. So time is going by for all of us. We see the physical changes. We begin to realize how fast life is flying by. But the question is, according to God's clock, what time is it in my life? This could be my last year upon this earth. It could be your last year upon this earth. You may be younger or older than I am. Age has nothing to do with it. Turn over to James chapter 4, verse 14. James chapter 4, verse 14. The Bible compares the shortness of our lives to many different things in different places. I'm going to use just one example here in James chapter 4, verse 14. I came up with other examples too as I was studying through this. But the one here in James, I thought, said it pretty well. James 4, verse 14. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? That's the question. What is your life? The answer. It is even a vapor that appears for a little while, then it vanishes away. So James asks a very important question. What is your life? And he answers it. You are like the mist that appears for a little while, then it vanishes. You can picture in your mind a teapot with steam coming out of the top of it. When the water starts to boil, you can see the steam coming off the top, the vapors. But it only lasts for maybe a foot or two above the teapot, and it just vanishes away. It's gone within seconds. It vanishes. That is what your life is, a vapor that appears, and then it's gone. You can also picture a foggy morning, like in a valley. We live kind of down in that valley, and we get a lot of fog there in the mornings. But no matter how thick the fog or how heavy the fog is early in the morning, it doesn't take very long. As soon as that sun comes out, it's gone. The mist is gone. That is your life. You are a mist, a fog that appears for a short time and then vanishes away. Other places in the Bible, our lives are compared to a wind that just blows by, or a cloud, or a wilting flower that grows and dies. So we ask the question, what time is it in your life? Question number two, what time is it in the church? Turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 4 to answer this question. What time is it in the church? 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 to 2. Now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. Here we find the answer to the second question. Paul talks about the situation that will be found in the latter times. So if we see this type of situation, we know what time it is. It must be the latter times. We will find some departing from the faith because of deceiving spirits. People speaking hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. We have all seen hypocrisy. Preaching one way, living another. Scriptures say that it won't even bother them to do it because their conscience has been seared and it's gone. As a result, people will fall away from the faith. So we ask ourselves, what time is it in the church? Question number three, what time is it in the world? What time is it in the world? Turn over to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy this time, chapter 3. Here Paul is talking about the last days of this world. He's talking about the latter days of this world and what will be happening in the world around us in the latter days, not just in the church. Start by reading in verse 1. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of monies, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure, rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. Now, do these words sound familiar? All we need to do is read a newspaper, watch the news in the evening. These words sound very familiar to all of us. The world around us is lovers of money, lovers of themselves. All you do is go to a bookstore, you will see the shelves filled with books emphasizing one's own importance, how to gratify your own desires and not how to help others. The Bible says the result is that we become boastful and proud and abusive, without self-control and brutal. Sounds like the world we see around us today. So what time is it in the world around us? We hear horrible stories of family members killing each other, total disobedience, disrespect, and lack of love for one another. We have become lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. People worship their money and their pleasures instead of worshiping God. Today, people are braggers, proud, blasphemers of God, without self-control. They are disobedient to parents. Everything that is listed here in 2 Timothy, we can see again and again in the world around us. So what time is it in the world? I've asked you three questions. What time is it in your life? What time is it in the church? And what time is it in the world? So do you know what time it is? The answer is, it's time to wake up. It's time to wake up. We cannot afford to be asleep during times like these. It is time for us to wake up. Have you ever had one of those nightmares when you're supposed to be ready for something in the morning, but you're not? And you get panicky at night while you're dreaming. You dream about making a speech at school or having a big project you're supposed to have done at school. And while you're dreaming that you get there and suddenly you realize you didn't do it and you get that panicky feeling. That's happened to me lots of times. Or maybe you dream that you're supposed to be making a big presentation at work and you forgot to do it. And you wake up in a panic because you dreamed that you didn't have it done. I've had this dream literally several times, more than several, lots of times. I dream a lot. But for me, I've had this dream about school, but I've also actually had this dream that I've had to speak at church and gotten up here and forgot to prepare a sermon. I've actually have had that dream. That I've gotten up here and realized I didn't do anything or I forgot. And you get that panicky feeling. So I definitely know what it feels like to have this type of dream and wake up in a panic. Like I said, this type of thing has happened to me in the past. But what a relief it is when you suddenly realize you wake up, wait, that was just a dream. You feel relieved when you wake up and realize it's just a dream. It didn't really happen. A nightmare like that can be terrifying. But it is far worse when a person has fallen asleep spiritually and wakes up to realize that he is not ready when Christ returns for his second coming. Because then it will be too late and it won't be just a dream. A person is about to go before the King of Kings and the creator of the entire universe when they suddenly realize they didn't prepare. They aren't ready. And they wish it was a nightmare, but it's not. It will be a terrifying reality. The Bible tells us again and again that the day is coming. The day of Christ's return is coming. The end of the world as we know it is on its way. The Bible continuously tells us that we are living in a special time. So why must we wake up? Spiritually wake up? Because of the nearness of Christ's return. And it's not always a chronological nearness, because you can always make the argument, well, you know, Paul, back in the New Testament, he thought it was very near then, too. That was 2,000 years ago. But it's not always a chronological nearness, but it's a spiritual nearness for all of us. Even in Paul's day, he could say that his return was going to be very soon. Even if it wasn't strictly a chronological point of view, Christ's return, as I said, was about 2,000, at least 2,000 years into the future. But from Paul's point of view, from the point of view of how much time he had left, it was very soon. And that's the point I'm trying to make. From his little speck on that timeline, that area that he had to live his physical life, it was very soon. There are many references in the New Testament that show how close his return is. I'm going to quickly go over three here. Philippians 4. Verses 4 to 5. It says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. The second one I have here is in 1 Timothy 4, verse 7. 1 Timothy 4, verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. The third one I have here is in 1 John 2, verse 18. It's a short one. Little children, it is the last hour. Now, even as I mentioned before, even if these things were written a long time ago, at least in our minds, by our way of recollecting, really on that timeline that I was talking about before, it wasn't very long ago. But in our minds, it seems like a long time ago. For the men that wrote them, it was their last hour. It may be our last hour for us as well. Now there's another example of this type of warning found in Romans 13. Now, I'm going to spend a little more time on these groups of verses here in Romans 13, verses 11 to 14. Because there's several points or lessons that I think that we can get out of these verses here in Romans 13, verses 11 to 14. We can dig a little deeper in these scriptures and see the urgency that Paul felt when he wrote this. Romans 13, verse 11. And do this knowing the time, that now is high time to awake out of our sleep. For now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in the revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for flesh, no to fulfill its lusts. Now, there are 4 points about the urgency for us to wake up that I'm going to make regarding these scriptures here in Romans 13:11. There's 4 points that I'm going to make about the urgency for us to wake up. The first one is, now is the time to wake up. Not later, but now. Now is the time to wake up. Paul says in verse 11, and do this knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of your sleep. For now our salvation is nearer than we first believed. Now it is high time to wake out of our sleep, Paul tells us. Now no one likes to sleep in more than I like to sleep in. Most of you know that I like to sleep in. It's one of my favorite things to do is to sleep in the mornings. But now is not the time to hit the snooze button spiritually and to keep sleeping. Paul warns us that now is the time to wake up. And notice that Paul's not talking to unbelievers here. He's talking to people who already believe. He says that the salvation he speaks of is nearer than when we first believed. In other words, Paul is talking to those of us who already believed. And it's nearer than when we first believed. People like you and me. There is no time to wait. Because as we discussed earlier, we have no idea just how much time we really have in this life. If you want to turn over to James chapter 5. James chapter 5, verses 7 to 9. Another verse reiterating the urgency. James 5, verses 7 to 9. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Another verse reiterating the urgency. It will not be long until the judge is standing at the door. And if we wait until he is standing at the door to wake up, it's going to be too late. So then, now is the time to wake up. The time is now. The second lesson I have here to glean out of these verses, the second lesson is, now is the time to get dressed. Once you wake up, what's the first thing you do? You get dressed. So now is the time to get dressed. Not only do we need to wake up, but we need to get dressed. Romans 13, verse 12. Back to, hopefully you didn't lose your place there in Romans, because I'm going to keep going back until I'm done with these 4 points. But Romans 13, verse 12 says, the night is far spent and the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of God. Paul tells us to put off the works of darkness and to put on the armor of light. Of course, darkness is a figure of speech that represents this present time or this present world that we live in. This present time that will be coming to an end. And of course, the armor of light that we would put on is Christ and his coming kingdom. Keep your place there, but go over to 1 Thessalonians now, chapter 5. We'll be coming back here to Romans 13, but I want to go over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and read a couple more verses that talks about what we should be putting on, how we should be dressing ourselves once we wake up. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, 1 to 11. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when you say peace and safety, the sudden destruction comes upon you. Comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman. And they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness. So again, we are supposed to put off the darkness. So that this day should not overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do. Again, you got to wake up first and then put on your clothes as others do. But let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night. But those who sleep, sleep at night. And those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love and a helmet of the hope of salvation. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you are doing. So Paul tells us here again that we are to put off the works of the darkness. We're supposed to put on something else. Of course, that's the armor of light. The works of darkness are things that people do under the cover of darkness, and they want to keep secret, like sin, stuff they want to keep secret, stuff they want that they know is unacceptable, stuff men which men know could cause hurt, stuff that they are perhaps ashamed of. But the armor of light, that is what we should wake up and put on. The breastplate of faith and love and the helmet of the hope of salvation. So the third lesson that we need to notice here in Romans 13, the third lesson to learn from these verses is now is the time to start walking. We learned that now is the time to wake up, now is the time to get dressed, and of course, now is the time to start walking. That's the third point. Once you've woken up and got dressed, it's time to get out the door. And so Paul gives us another lesson in verse 13. If you're back to Romans 13 again, I'm going to read verse 13. Romans 13, 13. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy. Let us walk properly, it says. So now we are to wake up, put on what we're supposed to be putting on, and we're supposed to walk properly. Now the word properly here means honestly, decent, nobly. We are to walk honestly before God. We are to have a life of honesty, decency, and nobility. We are to walk in the daylight, meaning we are not to hide or try to hide anything we are doing. In other words, we are to walk in a way that someone who woke up and put on the armor of light would walk. Turn over to Ephesians 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Here we are told more about how we should be walking. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 to 7. Think about how you should be walking when I read this. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 to 7. Therefore, be imitators of God, dear children, and walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. That's how we should be walking. But fornication and all uncleannesses or covetousness, let it not be named among you, as it is fitting for saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting. So these are things that are not fitting for us once we put on Christ and once we start to walk in his way. For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with the empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes down upon those sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. So this is how we are supposed to be walking. So far we have learned here in Romans 13 that now is the time to wake up. Now is the time to get dressed. And now is the time to start walking. But there's one more lesson, the fourth lesson here. Now is the time to put on Christ. That's the fourth lesson. Now is the time to put on Christ. Back to Romans 13 again. This time I'm going to read verse 14. Romans 13, verse 14. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. You and I should have a new identity, a new direction, a new purpose in our lives when we put on Christ. Turn over to Galatians 3 now, verses 26 to 27. Galatians 3, verses 26 to 27. For you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. For as many of you that were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. So we can see here that to put on Christ means to be baptized into Christ. That's how we put him on. Well, that's how we start. Galatians 3, verse 26. We have all put on Christ when we are baptized. We are all to put on Christ like he is our clothing. To continue on the analogy that I've been kind of going through here in Romans 13, you need to wake up, you need to get dressed, you need to start walking out of the darkness and into the light, and then you need to clothe yourself in Jesus Christ. When you think of clothing protects us, it warms us, it covers us, and it hides us. I think in many ways that's what he does. So to wrap this part up, what time is it? So what time is it? It's time to wake up. It's time to get dressed. And it's time to start walking. And it's time to put on Christ. But suppose I don't want to wake up. Suppose you're like me. You don't want to get up in the morning. You want to sleep in. You want to hit the snooze alarm. I want to sleep in. I don't want to get up. I don't want to wake up right now. I've got too many other things in my life going on to wake up and do these things. So then what? Well, Christ tells us then what. If you want to start turning over to Matthew 22, I'm going to go through some scriptures here in this parable in Matthew 22. Because it tells us then what. It tells us what will happen if we decide we'd rather sleep in. We'd rather not wake up just now. We'd rather wait. Turn over to Matthew chapter 22. These words come directly from Jesus Christ. It's a parable, as I mentioned. And of course, it's the parable of the wedding feast. Matthew 22, verse 1. And Jesus answered and spoke to them again by a parable and said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out all his servants to call all those who were invited to the wedding. But they were all not willing to come." Now you would think it would be a great joy and a honor to go to the king's son's wedding feast. And there was lots of preparations made, but some refused to come. So the servants had to be sent out again to tell them what a great feast it was going to be. In verse 4, Matthew 22, verse 4. "Again he sent out his servants, saying, 'Tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen, my fatted cattle are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding.'" Again, the invitation was sent out again, because the first time they declined the invitation. "The elite of the elite will be invited. The tables are set. Everyone is excited. Everything is special and ready to go. When God does something, he does it the very best. Everyone should be getting excited. Everyone should want to go. God Almighty has made an extensive preparation for his wedding banquet. The singers have been called. The wedding garments have been ordered. The food has been prepared. Everything is ready. And the invitation was sent out." All you need to do is respond to the invitation. But they all refused to come. All these people refused to come to this wedding dinner. Now Jesus is telling this parable to the religious leaders of that time. He was speaking to the Pharisees, we can see. What a shame it would be to be invited to this magnificent banquet and refuse to respond. Matthew 26, verses 5 to 6 now. "But they made light of it and went on their ways, one to his own farm, one to his own business. And the rest seized the servants and treated them spitefully and killed them." That's in verse 6. So not only did the guests ignore his invitation, but they ignored it and just went home. Went back to their farm, back to their business. They had other things to do. They weren't ready to accept this invitation. Others even seized the messengers and tortured and killed them. Now you might be saying to yourself, "Well, this parable has nothing to do with me." I'm not so sure. The people he was talking about here, he was talking to here, of course, were the chief priests and the Pharisees of that time. That was the immediate audience that he was talking to, the religious leaders of God's chosen people. Of course, they were the religious leaders of the Jewish people at the time, this, who he was speaking to. These were the men who thought they knew all that there was to know about God. These were the leaders of God's chosen people. And clearly Christ was showing them that they did not know all that they thought they knew. They were the religious leaders of God's chosen people at the time. And they were blind as to who Christ really was, even as he was speaking directly to them. Something for us to think about. So we should not be so proud for ourselves either, thinking that we are the chosen ones and that we know everything there is to know either. We know that Christ tells us that many will be called, but few will be chosen. I think these are important points for us to think about. I think we would be wise to heed the warnings in this parable, even if it may not have been originally speaking directly to us. It certainly has lessons for us today to learn from. I'm going to continue on now with this parable in verse 7, Matthew 22, verse 7. But then the king heard about it, and he was furious. He heard about these people refusing his invitation. And he was furious. And he sent out his armies, destroyed those murderers, and burned up the city. Clearly the king was not happy that some of those who were invited to this banquet did not take it seriously. He was angry that they had other things better to do, go back to their farms, go back to their businesses. That angered him, and he was very serious about it. He does not want us to be sleeping through his invitation to the wedding. Now, continuing on, verse 8. Then he said to the servants, "The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Therefore, go to the highways, and as many as you can find, invite them to the wedding." So the servants went out to the highways and gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. God is serious about his marriage supper. He has made extensive preparations. The banquet has been prepared. The fine meats are ready. He has set out his servants to fill the wedding hall with guests. And now I'm going to continue on verse 11. But when the king came to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. Verse 12. So he said to him, "Friend, how did you come here to a wedding?" Wait, "Friend, how did you come here without a wedding garment?" And the man was speechless. Of course, it was customary in those days for the host to provide garments to all the guests, wedding garments for all the guests to wear. And to not wear a wedding garment showed a lack of respect and a lack of appreciation for being invited. So the man had no real excuse, and of course he was speechless. He just stood there speechless. Verse 13, Matthew 22, verse 13. Then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot and take him away, and cast him into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Verse 14, "For many are called, but few are chosen." I think verse 14 summarizes the main point of this entire parable. The invitation or the call of God is extended to many, but there are few who receive it in such a way that they are chosen. This parable was given to the Jewish leaders at the time, but the lessons of this parable apply to us as well, because the invitation to attend the wedding feast is still being offered to us today. So with that in mind, think about this. Have you refused God's invitation through indifference, perhaps laziness, perhaps you're busy doing something else? And are you dressed appropriately for that wedding? Are you dressed appropriately for that wedding? Because we see what happened here to the man who wasn't dressed appropriately. We cannot show up to the wedding in our old rags that we used to wear, the same old clothes we used to wear. We can't show up that way. We must put on the new man and put on Christ to be prepared. God has everything ready to go for the greatest celebration of all time. The banquet hall has been prepared. The dinner is prepared. The messages have been sent out. Don't reject the invitation. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9. "But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love." He is preparing a wedding feast greater than any eye has ever seen or any ear is even ever heard of for those who are willing to accept that invitation. It's a wonderful thing to think about. So in conclusion, wrap this all up. When we look at all this that I just talked about, we must conclude that we have no more time to waste. Our time is short. In that timeline of eternity, we are just a speck. We are like a vapor coming off the teapot. Our time is short. We have no time to waste. Now, today, is the day of decision. Our salvation is at stake. We may have gotten away with procrastinating and putting things off up until now, But now he's here. Now is now. Now is today. Tomorrow is not promised to any of us. But now has been given to all of us. We all have now. Perhaps some of us won't have tomorrow. So do you know what time it is? Do you know what time it is? Well, it's later than it's ever been. The clock is ticking for all of us. So what time is it? It's time to wake up. It's time to get dressed. It's time to start walking, and it's time to put on Christ. Let's read back in Romans 13. I don't know if you're still there, if you still have it marked there, but I'll read it for you. We've already read this verse. Romans 13, verse 12. I want to just wrap this up by reading this verse one more time in Romans 13, verse 12. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness. Let us put on the armor of light. How many of you have ever slept outside under the stars sometime in your life? So if we raised our hands, we've probably all done that at some time in our life when we were younger. Maybe we still do it when we go camping with the kids. I would say that most of us at some point have slept out under the stars. So I want you to imagine, go back to that time in your mind, and imagine for just a minute you're back there, sleeping outside under the stars. Outside in the woods, maybe in a clearing in the trees where you can see up between the trees and you can see the sky. You snuggle down in your sleeping bag as you look up into the dark darkness above, into the dark sky above. Maybe you can smell the wet leaves and the pine needles, and you can hear the sounds that you hear in a summer night, like a crickets and maybe a hooting owl off in the distance, as you drift off to sleep, and you drift to sleep. Now the next thing that you know, you're starting to wake up. And you hear the birds chirping in the trees all around you. At first, you're just half awake. You know how you feel when you just start to wake up and you're not even sure where you're at. You kind of look around. Where am I at? What's going on here? You're a little disoriented. You're not sure where you really are at first, and the cobwebs start to clear out. The birds start making so much noise that you can't sleep anymore. Those of you who slept in the woods know those birds start to get noisy, and you just can't sleep anymore. Then you open your eyes and you start to look around. When you look up, you can see the orange and the purple streaks across the sky, as the sun is just starting to peak over the horizon. You can imagine being out at that time of the morning when it's just starting to get light. You just start to see that light, the orange light coming across the sky. I'm sure all of us have been outside at that point when the night is just starting to turn into the day. At the time when you can just start to see the light streaking across the sky. That is the time it is right now for all of us. That time when the night is just starting to turn to day is the time it is for all of us right now. The night, going back to Romans 13, the night is far spent. The day is at hand.